that come here on and meet with us, see what we'd like in order to do it.
Call the Higher Education Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum, and I think we'd like to begin with a motion to approve the minutes from April 6th. Do I hear a motion?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
And the Dempsey moves that minutes from Wednesday, April 6th, be approved. Any corrections? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oops, sorry about that. Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? There we go. And it's approved. Okay, we have a fairly full agenda, and for information for the committee and for the audience, we're going to try to get through the four bills we have, and our plan is to be here till 3 o'clock, so just stay comfortable. We could leave early. That's another plan. That's an alternate. But hopefully we do not have to meet this evening if this works out. So that's our plan. There are, on your agenda, it may show five bills. Representative Abler will not be presenting 1326 today. Before we begin with our first bill, I'd like to embarrass my family. My son is here, Rick, and his wife, Kim, and their three girls, Sydney, Taylor, and Maddie. Okay? They have to... I don't.
Rick, would you say hello, please?
No. He's in real estate. Oh. And he's open to listings, too. Okay, our first bill on the agenda is 1719, Representative Klinzing.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee. And I'll move House File 1719. And it goes to Ed Finance from here.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. All right, proceed.
Thank you. Well, thanks for hearing this bill today. What it does is provides incentive for high schools to provide more rigorous experience for high school students. And you may have received in your packets today a shortened summary of a study that was done by Achieve Incorporated. Anyway, this summary comes from the American Federation of Teachers and their American Teacher publication they send out, so it probably came to your mailbox. But just highlights that students want to be challenged in high school more than they have been, and we hope that this particular bill, Get Ready, Get Credit, will inspire that and encourage the districts to offer more college-level preparatory classes in the high schools. So there's a few things I think pertain specifically to higher ed that need to be discussed in here today. One of them is the fact that a lot of colleges will give students credits for having passed an advanced placement exam or an IB exam, international baccalaureate exam, at a certain level in college. And so there's a part in the bill that directs the MSU program to hopefully provide that same incentive of and that same requirement, or I should say that would the same credit for kids who pass advanced placement courses at a level of 3 or higher and IB courses at a level of 4 or higher, because the IB courses are on a 4-7 or 1-7 scale and the AP exams are on a 1-5 scale. We also would like to encourage you to do that as well. And so there's some language to encourage that. There's also a piece in the bill that we give students college level, or provide students with college level examination programs, which are college level tests that kids can take to test out of certain classes at the college level. They're designed, the courses could be any course that you have in your high school, but the student would have the option at the end of the course that is associated with the exam to test out of, for example, a calculus class and to show that they know how to do college-level calculus by getting a certain score through the college-level examination program. There are other pieces to the bill that don't pertain specifically to higher ed, so I don't know if you want me to go over those or not.
Only if members requested, I guess. I don't think that's necessary for this time. Do you want to call your witnesses?
Yeah, we have a couple of people from the state
Mary Ann Nelson. Good afternoon. Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Members of the committee, my name is Mary Ann Nelson. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Education. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. Representative Klingring has done a superlative job of summarizing the major need here. I would just add a couple of things from our data. All of us want Minnesota to stay as number one in the nation, and what's ironic is even though we score number one in things like an ACT test, and we tie Wisconsin for that number one status in the nation, when you look deeper at the data, there's a lot of evidence that suggests we have students who aren't being challenged to their level. We have many students who aren't taking rigorous courses. We know that from the data. We know that from the articles like last Sunday's Star Trib, where several students said they really want more challenge, more rigor in their high school courses. What is so compelling about this bill that Representative Klingring has is it looks at many areas that will promote higher rigor for students in high school. And so we would support that by putting APIB at a higher level, by promoting CLEP as an access route for students to be able to earn college credit while in high school if they can demonstrate that they have met the performance requirements, and the EPOS that my colleague is here, Assistant Commissioner Pat Olson is here to testify on EPOS and the major impact that will make. All of these together will have a huge impact on our high school students because we want more to take rigorous courses. By the way, many of our high school students are afraid to take higher rigor courses because of a GPA concern. Yet the research says even if you take the higher rigor, you take that AP, that IB course, even if you're afraid you won't score well, you will do better in high school and you certainly will do better in college. At this time, if it's all right, we could ask Assistant Commissioner Olson to come forward, unless you have a question for me.
Any members have a question of Ms. Nelson? Representative Dempsey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Nelson, what seems to be the problem that you're trying to correct in the public school system?
Ms. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, what we're trying to correct is a lack of awareness on the part of students of the importance of rigorous courses, good career planning taken early. And we're also trying to correct the problem that occurs in some areas of not enough access to the tests by expanding the subsidies that are available for students, particularly low-income students. We're also trying to create solve the problem of lack of awareness of what these are. We just had a meeting not too long ago with some people from higher ed, and we were sharing together, Representative Dempsey, until the governor's bill, there really wasn't even much awareness on the part of some people about CLEP, the College Level Education Program. So by virtue of your having it in front of your committee and are having these kinds of discussions, we think all of those will promote students doing better because they'll be aware high school counts. You can make a difference in your career by doing well in high school. And one way to do well is to take rigorous courses early, to be aware of what it means to be ready for college, and then to help in every way we can so that they will be prepared. And college is a misnomer in some sense. Higher ed uses that broadly. We mean any post-secondary, whether you're going to advanced work, post-secondary, college level. Those require more preparation and better on the part of students in high school.
Representative Clinzing has something she wants to
just real specifically, just to give an example of another problem that fixes that wasn't mentioned, and that is with the EPAS system, students in 8th grade will be taking ACT-like examinations, which are put out by the ACT testing company. And what it does is it helps students who maybe don't come from college preparatory or college-educated households to understand the importance of doing well on an ACT and what an ACT is like and what it means. And they get that opportunity to kind of practice taking tests like that and knowing what those expectations are before they hit 11th grade. It gives them some practice up ahead of time. And so that's another place where it's specifically trying to help students. And it's a particular problem, and that would be an awareness issue, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, the students that I think you're, correct me if I'm in error, the students that you're primarily concerned about are those that are possibly A and B students, am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, we're concerned about the students who are underachievers as well, those who are maybe at FDC levels, frankly. This whole notion of trying to get students early, I myself was a teacher in the system and an administrator for many years, and as a part of the department outreach, we've talked to principals and teachers and curriculum directors, and the teachers have very compelling testimony about the difference this makes for student awareness. But it's not just at the A and B students. It's when we start to see students underperforming, the earlier that we can promote the chance of your future is in your hands, and you can do it. It's the American work ethic. It's believing in yourself. It's taking good courses early. In my own experience as a teacher, I've seen many students, sometimes my own son, say, well, I want to go to college, of course. They'll say that in 6th and 7th grade, but they don't start to think about what that might mean for the course selections. And when students move from middle to junior high or middle school, and when they move from middle to high school, they are making some key course choices. By virtue of raising the bar higher for everybody, the IP, the AB, the CLEP, making this more accessible to students, and the fact that EPAS goes to the grade 9 and 10 students in terms of a test that's not just for the school success. This is for me to see how well I am doing. Am I on a line to be ready for school? So we're really looking for all of our students to have the rigor raised.
Representative Dempsey,
thank you. And one last question then. The programs that you're proposing here to solve the problem, will they be acceptable to the universities of the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, yes, we do believe they will.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
that's a problem. You believe they will. My question was, what will?
They will.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Pulaski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is to follow up on Representative Dempsey's question. I'm on page 5. I'd like to know how much of this bill we actually need, given phrases like are encouraged to, may reimburse, may do. And I'm going to be specific. On page 5, lines 5 through 11, it says the Minnesota State Colleges and University System must award for international baccalaureate advanced placement. So could I have someone from Minsky come up and tell me that your colleges do not right now and why they don't? And I've got a couple other questions.
Mr. Chair,
please identify yourself.
My name is Cindy Christ. I'm System Director for P16 Collaboration for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. The Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system currently has policies governing the award of credit for AP and IB. For AP, which is the biggest program, the policy states that in most cases, credit will be awarded for a score of 3 or above. It does provide in the policy an option where an institution can demonstrate that a score of 3 is not sufficient to indicate likely success at higher levels, that a higher score can be set. And we have a few institutions that do require a 4, a very limited number, mostly in physics and calculus.
Representative Pulaski.
So, Mr. Chair, what I'm reading on page 5, lines 5 through 11, you are already doing, and you may be doing it with an even added amount of rigor than this encouraging and must language would do. So I'm just curious that this language is here. Could I have someone from the U then come up and tell me what their policy is, University of Minnesota, since they're mentioned here too? No one from the U?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, I think I may have a copy of the U's policy in my folder.
If you do, could you...
Yes, I'll look for it, and so I hand it to you when I find it. It's essentially the same.
Mr. Chair, I'll tell you what. If you say it's essentially the same, if you find out that it is not... I talked it down, but if you say it's essentially the same, that's for the record. So once again, we've already got this in place. This paragraph would seem to be almost useless, and it goes with what Representative Dempsey is saying. They appear to already be doing it. Why do we need this comfort language in the bill? Then I'm going to go down to lines 14 through 22. The college level examination program, so as long as you're here, can someone from higher ed tell me how this language would differ from what we're doing now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, members of the committee, you're specifically asking about the CLEP test,
yes.
Correct? I was just looking at some information that our system recently collected on CLEP policy. And what I noted is that all but one of our institutions currently have policies regarding the award of credit for CLEP tests. The only one that does not is a technical college. And I can follow up with them, but my assumption is they don't have their own policy because they haven't needed one. They have not had students that have requested credit. Of the remaining institutions, 29 of them award credit both at a general level and a subject level for CLEP scores, and I believe it's 5 others either award credit for one or the other. So all but one of our campuses, institutions, currently award credit for CLEP tests.
So it would appear that this paragraph is taken care of. So let's move on to the next one. On page 5 of subdivision 2, lines 23 through 35, on line 24 and then again on line 30, I see the line, the state may reimburse, and then on line 30 again, the state may reimburse. I'm wondering, may reimburse, if the author could tell me, may reimburse, what does that mean? Why are we saying they may? They could then, right now, if they wanted to. Why are we saying may? What's the difference between current law and having a may in there?
Representative Pulaski, Mr. Chair, I think this is language that we provide a certain amount of money in this bill, and we're not from the outset saying we're giving, you know, $1 million to AP, $1 million to IB, and $1 million to CLEP. We're saying that we're going to reimburse up to the total amount we have, and if it comes in that we do more in reimbursements for CLEP out front, there might be a little less at the end.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Moss. Mr. Chair, Representative Cleansing, could the department do it without this language? Assuming they had the funds.
I'm not sure. There are some things they can do without our statutory pointing out, and there are other things they can't do without us statutorily putting it in there. And on this particular one, I guess I'm not, I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is mushy may, may do it. Can the department tell me, do you absolutely need a may in order to do something?
Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, you asked the question of Representative.
Lines 23 through 35 and 24. Well, it's actually 23 and 24 and line 30. You've got a couple may reimburses in there. I wonder why we need the may reimburse. Why isn't it must reimburse? A may would tell me you can already do it.
We cannot already do what we're asking for in the bill, and maybe there can be a change in the language to must. My understanding is that we are expanding the funding of CLEP with this language.
So, Mr. Chair and Assistant Commissioner Nelson, you're saying that unless this language is there, you cannot reimburse at all for CLEP. Is that right?
Representative Clinton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, on the last page, on page 10, you'll see that we're appropriating $825,000 in 2006 and $1,006,000 in 2007. If we run out of monies at the end of that amount, the money won't be there for the department to reimburse. And so they may reimburse up until that point, but as soon as we hit that point, then they might not.
I would hope you'd reimburse without us giving you new money. The fiscal conservative that I am, I would hope that you'd do this because it's just a good thing to do and that the department would find the resources. So if you don't get the appropriation, if the appropriation doesn't come, and this language remains in place, would then the department find the resources internally to do the reimbursement if you didn't get the appropriation?
This, Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, the department does not currently have this authority, and they do need it, and it is our understanding that this particular language with the may reimburse is that we are giving them the authority to reimburse for CLEP.
Mr. Chair, that's not my question, Representative Clensing. My question is this. If you do not get the appropriation, this language remains. Would the department find the resources to make that reimbursement if you don't get the appropriation?
Ms. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, the may is in there for a specific purpose. We have to pay on a first-come, first-served. There is not enough money to pay for a must. So the may is to give the department authority, which we currently do not have, to reimburse, and replace the may in the language so that when the money is capped and the money runs out, that is when the dollars are not given.
If he doesn't get funded, will the department find money?
If we do not get funded, the department does not have money at this level to administer and pay for students' reimbursement on CLEP. I might answer to Mr. Chair with their discretion. There was an earlier question about do we need the earlier versions on lines 5 through 11 for this. What we're talking about, in other words, do we need to ask for this agreement across higher ed? What we're talking about is consistency here for students. And what happens in policies, they can change. They can be changed by a department who makes it a level of 4 or maybe even a 5. And we're trying to promote access that's consistent for students in the state. There is no policy across Minsky. There may be individual policies, as Cindy Christ has said, but we have been told there's no policy across the whole Minsky. And there is a substantial lack of awareness about CLEP. We understand that, too, in some areas. So while we already have it being accepted, we would just like to say the commissioner would set what that score is, the criterion, in partnership with higher ed. So we're looking for a consistent banner across all students in the state.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner Nelson, who gives the college credit? Assistant Commissioner Nelson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Who gives the college credit? The Minsky system or the accredited university? You're asking for college credit here. I'd like to know. Who gives the college credit? The Minsky system or the accredited university at which the student is attending?
We are looking at the Minsky system.
Mr. Chair, I'd like the Minsky system to come up and tell me what credit they give as a system that is not associated now with an accredited university. Because that's a surprise.
Identify yourself, please, for the
record. Mr. Chair, Cindy Christ, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I hope this isn't a trick question. One of my colleagues will correct me if I'm wrong. I believe credits are awarded by our institutions under the authority of our Board of Trustees.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Palacios.
But the credit is from the accredited institution, not from the Minsky system. And if policies are already in place at the college or university level, again, it would seem we're cluttering up the statute books with non-essential language. It's already in place. And if the university wants to come up and, at this point, can you tell me what the university does with international baccalaureate and advanced placement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities international baccalaureate?
I see Donna Peterson's back there, and I think you would talk to her. If the university wants to come up and confirm their policy in relationship to lines 5 through 11 on international baccalaureate and advanced placement.
Mr. Chairman, Donna Peterson, University of Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pawlowski, I apologize we don't have the correct people here today. One is out of town and the other was having surgery. I'm not sure what we have on international baccalaureate, but on advanced placement, as I understand it, we have policies for accepting those credits depending upon what category it's in and what level. And on college and the schools, as I understand it, if the classes have been taken from the certified programs, we accept those credits.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Walsh,
and Ms. Peterson, on page 5, lines 5 through 11, would you need that language in order to award college credit for advanced placement international baccalaureate since you already have it?
Mr. Chairman, for the University of Minnesota, the language is that we are encouraged.
I know you're encouraged through the other is a must. I'm just trying to make sure that if we could avoid an encouragement or a must, I'd like to do it since you're already doing it.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that would be necessary on our part in that we have been working towards having some kind of a system in place for these. And I think that many of the freshman students that we accept already come to us with credits, so we want to be very careful about making certain that we are in a position to accept those credits.
Okay. Mr. Chair, so far I haven't heard anything here that tells me why we need this bill, but...
Representative Clinton.
Thank you. Well, first of all, this bill is about much more than the one paragraph you picked out. Secondly, I think what this paragraph does is it is putting into place language that is going to require dialogue and consistency across the schools in the state and the university system. One thing that I have noticed with students who are not familiar with the ins and outs of applying to college because they didn't grow up in a household that knows how to do this is that they get very confused very quickly about which college wants what and when it comes to credits. If we're going to be promoting we're incentivizing in this bill directly with money appropriations and specific authority to the department to be providing monies for tests they weren't providing before, then and these are for the purpose of helping kids become more prepared for college at earlier levels, then that dialogue needs to be happening, and there needs to be a requirement there for that dialogue to be happening across college and high school levels, rather than there being this rift, or inconsistency that's causing a rift between the students, the Minnesota students who are applying and the colleges they're applying to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clinton, this is the Higher Education Committee, and I was referring to the sections dealing with higher education. Mm-hmm. And unlike K-12, the Minsky system does not give credit the institutions do, and the institutions are doing it at an institutional level, as is the University of Minnesota. You haven't demonstrated to me that this would do anything other than what they're already doing. And in fact, I'm wondering why we have the Department of Education addressing these things and not HESO, in that this would be a higher education service office area rather than the Department of Education. I know it deals at least somewhat with K-12, but certainly when we're talking about blanket policies for the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system, it would seem to be appropriate that HESO should make a comment on this instead of, or an adjunct to, the Department of Education. Mr. Chair, it's bills like this that, since we're already doing it, and the systems are involved in it, and the colleges who are giving out the credit have the program, I wonder why we take the time when we have 100 other things we could be doing rather than cluttering up the statute books with this. That's basically my point.
Representative Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Quinson, there's a focus on the ACT in this bill with the E-Pass program and whatnot, and I'm wondering if there's been any thought given to what impact, if any, that kind of focus would have on students who desire to attend institutions that do not accept the ACT but will only accept the SAT. I know the ACT is the more popular aptitude test in the Midwest, but most institutions in other parts of the country, I think, accept the SAT and not the ACT. So have you given any thought to what, if any, interconnection there is there?
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Latz. I am going to defer to the department on this at first, since they've been working with the EFAS system for a longer time.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, I'm Patricia Olson from the Department of Education. I'm in charge of assessment and NCLB. Mr. Chairman, Representative Latz, the purpose of the EPASS system is to give early information to the students on post-secondary skills, not only for the ACT colleges, but for post-secondary in general. What the EPASS does, in addition to a sort of practice for an ACT-like exam, it also provides a lot of self-counseling information for students who want to be successful in college. They should have taken these kind of classes, or they take these kind of classes in high school. And it gives a student a chance to compare what they have taken, what they need to take before it's too late, before they hit their, you know, junior or senior year and find out they haven't taken the right classes in freshman or sophomore year. So in addition to helping them with the Midwest ACT-type colleges, it would also help with, you know, colleges that accept the SAT instead.
Representative Lyons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We were told in Ed Policy that we'd get to see this bill again, higher ed finance, and there were some lingering questions, I think, from Ed Policy. I'm not sure some of this stuff overlaps, but there were going to be some changes, as I understood it, to the bill as introduced between Ed Policy and certainly one of the next stops that Representative Quinzing had indicated she'd be working on, substantive changes, which would involve an office amendment. Actually, to some of the questions that were raised at Ed Policy, and I regret that I wasn't here at the very beginning of this meeting, but did I miss any author's amendments? I should note Representative Biskins indicated that he would encourage Representative Quinzing to consult with me on the specific questions I had in preparation of those kinds of amendments. I haven't heard anything from Representative Quinzing, so I'm inquiring if I missed something in the hearing today.
We have not adopted any amendments. Representative Quinzing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Latz, the reviser has been working on the amendments and have it prepared for Ed Finance because it's more apropos to that committee, and it had to do with the teacher stipend language is what I recall. And I don't have a draft to show you yet, so hopefully by noon today.
By noon today?
Well,
that'd be nice.
Well, I'm telling you what I heard.
Additional questions, Representative Lance?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, In connection with the teacher stipend provision, Representative Quinson, you had indicated that you would be making some changes, you intended to make some changes anyway, in connection with what level of, what score on the AP or the IB courses would allow or require for teacher stipends to be made. But there was a pretty substantial debate about whether or not that was even appropriate, particularly in light of the fact that by the time a teacher gets a student as a junior or senior taking these courses, that lots of teachers in 9th, 10th grade before that have had a big impact on preparing a student to be successful on those tests. So my understanding, there was a real question is whether or not you were even going to include that section in there. Can you give me some idea what amendment you've directed the reviser to prepare? Since I'm not on Ed Finance, I won't see it again, but Representative Biskins assured me I'd have a chance to talk about the bill in higher ed finance. So, not this chairman hasn't assured that, but I'm hoping that you're alone.
If you can briefly answer the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Watts, what the language does is it strikes the teacher stipend language and directs half of that money to subsidies for test examination fees and the other half to teacher training stipends. So it'd be... the money would go to the teachers to go to the trainings, which are usually out of the city.
And Representative Black.
Mr. Chairman, along that line then, is it intended that those, that money that would no longer go to teacher stipends would go to teacher training in private schools as well as in the public schools? Is that your intent, Representative Quinson?
Representative Quinson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Latz, that language that had been in law since 1998 as a result of Becky Kelso's her legislation that she brought forward was actually stricken in ed policy. So we have stricken that non-public subsidy from our state statutes in this legislation. So something we've been doing since 1998 we will no longer be doing.
So, Mr. Chairman, then the revisers that's preparing the amendment would not be reinserting non-public teacher training in connection with that. Is that what you intend to then bring before at Finance?
Representative Clinton?
I have not directed the reviser to include non-public in the amendment.
Representative Lance.
Thank you. Also, Mr. Chairman, there is still a provision in this bill that appears to subsidize non-public students' examination fees, first for low-income families. I'm looking on page 4, lines 21, 22 in there. And then also to pay for all portion or all of the exam fees, including non-public students sitting for the exams. Was it your intention to maintain the subsidies for non-public students in connection with that, Representative Quincy?
Representative Quincy.
Yes, Representative Latz, Mr. Chair, Representative Latz, that's something we've been doing, and I wasn't intending to change that.
All right,
Representative Latz.
I won't, but I do have a higher ed question. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman. Sort of following up on Representative Pawlowski's line of questioning, I'm afraid that either the provisions in Section 6 and I guess 7, that particularly 6, that either it is redundant to current practice or it would be the state usurping what I perceive to be the legitimate decision-making role and authority of the higher education institutions themselves in connection with whether and to what extent to grant degree credit for success in any particular exams. If, as is apparently the widespread practice, NINSCU is already granting credit for most situations in which a 3 or higher is achieved on an AP or an IB exam, then it's redundant. But if, as Minsky has indicated, for particularly physics and calculus, this bill would require that rather than achieving a 4, that credit be granted for a 3, then I raise the question, who are we to make that decision on behalf of an accredited educational degree-granting institution? I certainly don't feel qualified, and I would submit that the commission is probably not qualified to review the physics test, the AP physics test, and then review the physics course at a particular NISCU institution and determine whether or not getting a 3 instead of a 4 ought to qualify a student for that credit.
Representative Plinzing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Latt. So as I stated before, I think the consistency issue is paramount, and I think that these dialogues have been going on for a long time between the higher ed systems and the high schools about how to have students more prepared coming out of high school. And here's a bill that is giving, trying to get more college preparatory curriculum into the schools, but there's got to be some sort of credibility going with it, some sort of consistency in the state system so that students don't feel like they're not sure if doing this particular course or this particular test is really going to get them into the system, because they don't always know in ninth grade whether they're going to be going to the U of M or whether they're going to be going to St. Cloud or Harvard or Cambridge, which also accept these same score levels for AP exams and IB tests. I think that it's just very important to have this kind of consistent policy, and that's why the language is there.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chair, yes. I was going to add to, that the universe or the Wisconsin system does have a consistent policy across all their system, and having done a lot of student teaching there, there was a notable difference in kids in high school who were preparing, kind of knowing exactly what was going to be expected of them.
Did you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some of my colleagues have urged me to be sure that you're clear about something. Now, I was going to respond earlier. Assistant Commissioner Nelson believed she had said one thing. My colleagues thought they heard another. So just to be sure we're all clear, let me just tell you. The Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, as a system, have a policy that say that credit will be given for AP scores of 3 or above. The policy does provide for limited options where there is research, data, to show that a higher score is necessary to ensure student success, that a higher score can be set. I was just looking through an annual report that the Minnesota Department of Education has online, and I found only 3 courses for which any of our institutions do not give credit for a 3. They were in calculus, physics, and at one institution in music theory. I didn't quite get through the whole list just now sitting there, so there could be one or two others. I might mention that Harvard does not give AP credit for 3s. They raised that a couple of years ago to 4, and I think it may be 5 now. So it's very fair to say that higher institutions, public and private, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and elsewhere, have policies governing the award of credit. Those policies are not all identical. If you look on the Wisconsin University of Wisconsin policy site, beyond their initial language, which is very encouraging of students, they do provide information about some courses for which only credit is only given for scores of 4 or 5. So I think it's very difficult for anybody to say that policies are not consistent, and especially I want to be sure that you know that the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities have a policy governing the consistent award of credit for AP. We have a policy governing the consistent credit for IB. We do not have a system-level policy on CLEP, and that's what Assistant Commissioner Nelson said. She was saying a few minutes ago, several of us in the audience thought we heard her say APIB. She either said or intended CLEP. I don't know if we misheard or if she misspoke. But she was correct that we do not have a system-level policy regarding the award of credit for CLEP. However, all of our institutions, save one technical college, do have policies. All of that information is readily available.
Representative Lance?
Mr. Chairman, that's very helpful. So it sounds like this would be both redundant and usurping certain institutional accreditation decisions or credit-giving decisions. I don't think the legislature ought to be in the position of dictating to an institution that is accredited for a reason that they must give credit for performance on either an AP or an IB test that they do not believe would be predictive of success in their comparable or their college-level course in that subject. I just don't think that's the appropriate or legitimate role of the state legislature. And, you know, maybe if there was some exception in the bill that gave them the flexibility, such as is present in NSCU's standards, that would be a different story. But I don't think we ought to be dictating that. And I would think that accreditation, the organization that grants the accreditation, would look askance at the legislature making those kind of decisions rather than the institution. If we're forcing an institution to grant degree credit for a score that would not get that student degree credit had the course been given at that university, that really undermines the accreditation process, it seems to me. But, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure where this bill is at, because I didn't hear the initial motion, if it's recommended to pass, or if you think, I would guess, because it's still got to go to Ed Finance.
That's correct.
Then it might be appropriate right now for me to make a motion to strike Section 6.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Fundy.
Representative Latz, would you be more comfortable if on line 9, instead, after the word of, we inserted at least a 3 or higher. And that way they'd have that flexibility to set 4s and 5s where they wanted.
Representative Lance?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that accomplishes this. Perhaps I could ask counsel for an opinion.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Latz, inserting the words on lines 9 of at least 3 or higher gives the MNSCU system some flexibility to set appears to give them some flexibility to set standards that are more rigorous than the ones that are contained in this subdivision. It still maintains that they must award credit. So it would depend on what your intentions were in making your motion.
Representative Lass.
Mr. Chair, counsel, I guess my intention would be to have a, if we're going to do this, and frankly I'd rather not see it even necessary to put this into state law, but if we were going to do this, I guess I should ask MNSCU if they thought the addition of at least in there would allow them to continue to implement their existing policy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Cindy Chris, I don't want to second guess individuals who know better than I do, perhaps, what language means in statute. When I hear must award at least 3 or higher, I hear that we have to give credit for 3s. I don't hear that language, at least 3 or higher, as providing any opportunities to only award credit for 4s or 5s. So as my ear hears that, it does not make it more flexible. But I don't know if I'm correct about that.
Mr. Chair.
To this point, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not unusual for me. I've got friends and supporters on both sides of this issue. And it seems to me that if the question is whether this legislature will, if on one part the question is whether this legislature will exert its influence to force, quote-unquote, institutions to do something that aligns with what we think is good public policy, I don't have any problem with that principle. I think what we have here is kind of a venturing into an area that's new for this legislature. It's the nexus between K-12 and higher ed. And I've been here 15 years, and it's very rare, in my experience, where we do a whole lot of talking in either one of these divisions about areas that ought to be intersecting with one another. And I could tell you, I don't know if you've read the National Governors Association's, you know, recent publication on this issue. It was just issued a month ago, Representative Quinson, the sort of the 10-point kind of plan for moving our educational system into another level that's really based on, you know, high expectations tied to college level outcomes, and being able to start that early on in K-12. That's a new proposition. It's not entirely new. We've always had tech prep, but it's new in terms of its scope and its challenge to state legislatures to do some pretty tough stuff that gets into, it starts to sort of blend the lines between K-12 and higher ed at a level that we probably have not had that happen before. And I frankly think that's generally a good policy direction, and I actually want to commend Representative Quincy for coming forward with this language. As I listen to the questioning, there's no question in my mind, however, that there continues to be some awkwardness in the language, and I think part of it is on the language Representative Latz is seeking to amend here. But I have just a couple of quick clarifying questions perhaps from Ms. Chris. You said, Ms. Chris, there's no system-wide policy administered in regards to this issue. I'm suspecting that the reason there isn't is because MISCU is a relatively new creation, and that perhaps these policies, if they exist, exist at the college and university level because that predates the MISCU system. So my question is that correct? Is that correct? And one, what's happening at MISCU in regards, if at all, at looking at a system-wide policy, and what's kind of your best wisdom in regards to that? And then there's a bunch of questions here. And three, seems to me that part of the issue here is what kind of credibility are we going to weigh IP or IB, I always screw those up, AP and IB coursework. I mean, you've heard that, appropriately so, for Representative Latz, we have institutions that are accredited by accrediting bodies, and we put a lot of weight in that because we're going to support those public institutions based on that accreditation. But we also support IB and AP realities in the state, and that's got to be tied to some credibility. There's maybe too many questions here, but you and I have known each other for a while. I think you kind of know what I'm thinking here. No system-wide standard, is that because this stuff predated the creation of the MISCU system-wide? Two, what's MISCU thinking about, if at all, about going to some kind of a system-wide system here in terms of recognizing these credits? And two, what can you tell us that might be reassuring or maybe not reassuring about the level of competency in IB and AP courses that would suggest to us that that's probably one of the best places to hang our hats in terms of this sort of new evolution of tying K-12 with higher ed. And you have like an hour.
Before you answer that, I wanted to just back up a minute. Did you officially make an amendment or a motion to amend, or was it just trying to clarify where we are here procedurally? So.
Yes, I did make a motion.
You did make a motion. Okay, we need to get back to that.
This is, I think, helpful.
Yes, will be helpful. So, please go ahead, Ms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, members of the committee. First of all, just let me clarify again. We do have a system-wide policy on AP and IB. At least two of the previous three systems, and perhaps all three, had AP and IB policies before merger, and worked to revise those into a single policy that I believe was in place by the time of merger. We do not have a CLEP policy. I do not know if either of the two-year institutions, two-year systems, had CLEP policies before merger. I know the state universities did not. I suspect that none did, because we had a process for dealing with the separate policies and working them into a single policy, and if only one system had a policy, we had a way of carrying them forward as a separate policy and then reviewing their need as the system proceeded through its evolution. So we do not have a CLEP policy. I believe that that's because there have not been problems brought to our attention by students seeking credit in response to taking CLEP tests. As you all know up here very well, you very seldom are asked to act on policy to address something that hasn't been a problem. You usually have an issue brought to you to be addressed when there's a problem to be corrected. So I believe that the fact that there's no CLEP policy likely indicates that we have not had problems with CLEP. CLEP was the CLEP tests were designed initially for adults coming to colleges and universities to get credit for prior learning, life experience. It's only pretty recently that the College Board has had language on their website, I believe, connecting CLEP in any way with recent high school graduates. Our institutions, many of them, give the tests. They generally do not, students are usually asked to take them, and they're not given until after a student is admitted to a college or university, and often until after they're enrolled. They look at courses available and see, I think I know enough to get credit for this, so I'm going to take this test and then see whether or not I can get credit or get advanced standing. So, you're correct that we do not have system-wide policy on CLEP, but we have not heard any evidence from individuals that we have reason to need one, that there are problems to be addressed by being more consistent. You asked some other questions that credibility, I think most people see AP and IB as very credible programs. I do recall several years ago some concerns about AP as courses as not being particularly consistent with what at that time was defined as standards-based teaching and learning. They're very heavy on content and memorization, and a number of years ago I know there are institutions that did not look particularly favorably on AP math and science courses. I don't know if that perception is still out there, and I frankly cannot tell you how widespread that perception was, but a number of years ago when I was on leave from Minsky working in the Department of Education for SciMath Minnesota, which is a statewide math and science reform project, we had many concerns about AP courses and tests in math and science, and it was at that time that some institutions stopped accepting credits for AP. But I have, I hear positive things about them from our institutions. The last thing I would say in response in part to your third question, I was looking last week at a report that was recently released by the U.S. Department of Education. I think it was completed at the request of the Office of Vocational and Adult Education, and they looked at a variety of opportunities for students to earn college credit while they're in high school. They particularly looked at dual credit programs, which is a generic name for our PSEO program. They also looked at AP and IB. They found, not surprisingly, very widespread use of all of those. The Midwest has been traditionally underrepresented nationally in AP and IB, but I think more fully represented in dual credit enrollment. And they also found that in many cases, states or schools that have strong dual enrollment programs have less strong or smaller AP and IB programs. So not in all cases by any means, but in many cases, high schools or districts or states that are strong in one of those areas are less strong in another. So they seem to take one approach or the other broadly to providing students with opportunities while in high school to earn college credit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative. Mariani.
On that last point, it seems to me that there may be more than one way to skin this cat, if you will. You staff the P16, Minnesota P16 Council, which is a pretty broad table, higher ed, K-12. I think that's it. I don't know if there is. Well, nonprofits. I don't want to create an awkward situation because one of your partners is sitting next to you in the Department of Education, P16 Council has spent some time talking about these issues, and I think the closest in regards to the possible 11th grade alignment test. In your opinion, if you're at liberty to say, are we at a point where maybe we're moving too fast here? Is there another way to try to skin this cat, if you will? What does the P16 Council need to hear or know in regards to this legislation, other than no? Because I do think this is pushing an appropriate policy front. How ready, I guess, in your mind, is the P16 Council to embrace this particular approach? Would it prefer perhaps to have some other approaches come forward?
Ms. Chris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, members of the committee, I think what I would say is that, in general, the issues that this legislation addresses are the kinds of issues that the Minnesota P16 Education Partnership has been discussing, would like to discuss. If I were to wave a magic wand and change anything, it would have been to have an opportunity through the P16 Partnership to discuss the recommendations in this bill, the initiatives that it puts forward, before it became legislation. That would be my personal magic wand. I think the issues that are being addressed here are very consistent with the priorities of the P16 Partnership. We have two broad priorities, and one is college readiness and transitions. And clearly, that's what the provisions in this bill are seeking to address. I very much, support and Minsky very much supports the idea of EPAS, of providing students with opportunities earlier in their middle school and high school career to assess their readiness for college. We think that's a good idea. We have no problems with the APIB program. We're not supportive of some of the specific language in the bill addressing the reward of credit. And we have, frankly, some concerns about CLEP and how CLEP might be used, particularly in ways that aren't addressed specifically in the bill, but that have been discussed in the context of talking about this provision.
Thank you.
We need to return to the amendment. Do you want to restate your amendment, Representative Lance?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my amendment was simply to delete Section 6. The Council has offered a suggestion that I find helpful. First, let me say, as Representative Mariani stated in Ed Policy, and I concurred at that time and will again, I like the general direction of this bill, and I commend Representative Klinzing for bringing this forward. I think it's the overall purpose of this bill is helpful and will make our state a stronger state. I just have some specific concerns, as I've already noted.
what council has suggested, which would be, rather than striking all of section 6, would be to add at the end of that section, specifically on line 11, insert a new sentence as follows: an institution may establish a minimum standard greater than a score of 3 to award college credit. Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that that would set the general policy at a 3, but it does give the institutions flexibility where they seem it is appropriate to raise a higher standard.
Thank you. Everyone have the language?
Mr. Chairman, would you read that again, please?
I can read it back.
Okay.
Here, Representative Weiss, would you read your amendment one more time?
An institution may establish a minimum standard greater than a score of 3 to award college credit.
Here. Representative Pulaski, did you have a comment on the amendment?
Well, on the amendment, the original amendment, but now that he's making
a new
proposal,
amendment.
I still have a comment and a question.
Before or after we vote?
Well, before would be better.
Can you make it real quick?
Real quick.
Okay,
I think the original Latz amendment is the amendment that this body should vote on. With the addition of the last sentence, we're still, all we're doing is codifying current actions of the system. And in fact, we just don't know the impact of that. But I have a question, Mr. Chair, dealing with the original amendment to the author for consistency's sake. Since we've used the word consistency, I want a consistent answer to a question.
The original amendment is no longer on the table. I assume you withdrew that, Representative Lance.
That's correct. Okay.
All right. Well, if that's part of it, still for consistency's sake, I have a question to the author.
Okay.
Representative Klensing, you used the word consistency a couple of times, and I'd like to know, for consistency's sake, why the private colleges aren't listed in this section, and what their policy is. Do they award on a 3 or below, or a 4 or a 5? And why, for consistency, aren't we including the private institutions for consistency?
Mr. Chair?
Polsky, I believe it is there.
Yeah, it's on line 7.
Is it on line 7? I'm sorry. I apologize for that. My fault
consistent.
For not reading. Be consistent, and I've got it.
Representative Cox, you have something to
add? Mr. Chair, just one other question.
Representative Polsky.
If we add the last language to this, how does it change what either, or the last language has been added. So how does it change what Minsky does right now? Can Minsky just tell me, you add that language, what does it do that you're not doing? I hate to get her up one more time, but I will.
I could just stay up here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Plosky, members of the committee, if I had another minute, I would have looked at our policy, but I believe that the language is very consistent with our policy. Okay. So the change in language would be consistent with our policy, which I suppose could beg the question, why you need the language if you're going to amend it so that it's exactly the same as our policy. But the amendment would make it consistent. And that's the issue. You know, we have institutions that don't want to give students credit for something and then set them up for failure. But it happens very seldom. It only happens in those areas where they have had experience with students not being successful with a score of 3.
Mr. Chair, as long as I made reference to the private systems, would the language that Representative Latz is offering, would that allow consistency in the private college institutions then also? Are there private college institutions that vary from 3 or 4?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, Mike Wilhelm, you may want to speak, but I can tell you from looking again at the report on the Department of Education website and AP, there are some private institutions that only award credit for scores of 4 or higher. So I don't know, in line with that policy, I suppose technically the change in language says an institution may may establish minimum standards greater than, that would allow them to continue doing what they're doing.
Sure, if they could respond, though, I'd like to know, since they're listed here, too,
then we're gonna
how this would impact the privates.
Mr. Wilhelmy, welcome to the committee. If you can briefly respond.
Mr. Chairman and members, Mike Wilhelmy, Minnesota Private College Council. All 17 members of the Private College Council do award. They have a policy for APIB. Most of them require at least a 3, and in some cases, the 4 is the minimum that's required. And also, as Ms. Christ also testified, we have some of the same policies as well, in which tests are not counted for credit.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wilhelmy, has there been any complaint about awarding at a 4 or a 5?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, not that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wilhelmy, would it be consistent to say that calculus, physics, music theory are the 3 in the Minsky system? Would it be similar in the private college system in those areas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, music theory certainly, I believe there's art. There's also an art test, which I believe some of our colleges don't accept. But that sounds about right.
Okay.
Members, we need to, unless you want to be back tonight. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, if I might. I think Representative Flensing, that we probably would be better off for now without even this section. But I think it raises enough issues. I'm not sure which way they go, one way or the other. So, Representative Latz, I think your language, I think Representative Lawson's point is well taken. Your language is basically puts us right back where we're at, which means, Representative Flensing, that if we're able to continue pushing forward a reform agenda here, we might have to come back to undo language that we just did. So,
Mr. Chair, I know you want to.
I recommend a no vote, but that's just me. I'm the chair. I would like to call the question.
I know you would, but I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, but what Mr. Wilhelmy mentioned raised a question in my mind. I think we ought to consider here, which is, and I hadn't occurred to me, and I guess I didn't pick it up when Ms. Chris had the earlier testimony. If there are some AP or IB tests that are simply not accepted because the institution has concluded that it is not indicative of success or helpful in that institution, the language that I have added here I don't think helps in that situation. It would require some credit to be granted, the way I've, with the additional language I've suggested. And my greatest concern is if a student comes in and because they had a 3 on an AP test or a 4 on an AP test, they're exempted from taking the first level of whichever class that is, and they jump right into level 2, and they find they can't handle that coursework. That is what's setting them up for failure. So,
are you withdrawing your amendment?
Well, I guess I am. I think in light of what Mr. Wilhelmy said and what Ms. Christ had said earlier about some tests simply not being accepted at all for credit, I think I need to revert back to my initial amendment, which is to delete Section 6. And I'm perfectly happy to try to work with Representative Quinzing or others to try to formulate a policy here that would advance the goals without unduly tying the hands of our credit institutions. But
I think if I'm hearing this correctly, Representative Latz withdraws the current amendment.
Yes,
and restates and moves it.
Simply to delete Section 6.
Okay. So you have withdrawn your amendment and made a new amendment which deletes Section 6.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'm not persuasive enough, Mr. Chairman.
All those in favor of the last amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no.
No.
And the amendment is defeated.
Division.
Okay, go on.
I can't hear so well from this vantage point.
Okay.
So
I heard clearly. But, all those in favor, raise your right hand. All those in favor, opposed, raise your right hand. This is just to get a count.
4 to 6, and the amendment fails. Okay. Representative Quinzing.
I know you don't want any more amendments, but this was supposed to have been taken care of in Ed Policy, and I note that on this engrossment it still says the wrong thing. So on line 10, I just would like to propose an author's amendment. I'm sorry, page 5, line 10.
Okay. And would you repeat that one more time?
It would say after the word or.
On which line?
Line 10.
Okay.
After the word or. Should say 4 or higher on the International Baccalaureate Program. That should have happened in the last time.
All right, we'll be renewing our motion for House File 179. Oh, I'm sorry. There was an author's amendment, correct? Then I'll renew my motion.
Mr. Chairman, we would still have to vote on that. That's you can't...
The author's amendment?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But if it were an amendment that were before us, then she could incorporate it. But as long as it's the bill before us,
it has to be technically
a vote.
All right, we'll do it the right way. Okay, then we need to vote on the amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Oh, the amendment is adopted. Now we're ready to again renew our motion. The House Bill 1719 passed and be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you. Okay, Representative Severson, are you still here?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's pretty non-controversial. Bill shouldn't take more than an
hour. Okay. You will have to sit down. Move House File 2145. And the motion would be to lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, to this bill, the bill kind of carries through on a theme of our veterans in higher education. We've had some occasion to revisit this process. Currently, when a veteran is recalled to active duty or called to active duty, he has the ability to step out of the school scene, get his tuition back, and get back certain reimbursements. One of the things we've run into since we've had some of our troops come home from overseas duty is they've had follow-on medical conditions which precipitate some extended stays, and sometimes when that happens in the middle of the educational session, they have to leave, and this bill addresses that situation, makes room for them to go ahead and leave and get those same benefits that the active duty member who is being called to active duty gets. The first being they can withdraw and get full credit for the person's tuition fees for the affected courses, and the right for readmission and re-enrollment within 2 years. Current existing law is 1 year. And without penalty or redetermination of eligibility. So they can exit for that medical purpose and then come back and pick up from there. Second portion would be they would receive a grade of incomplete or be allowed to complete the course upon completion of medical treatment or recovery from a medical condition. Or they continue to complete the course with the class sessions missed due to military service or medical condition being treated as excused absences. So if they had enough credit within the course that they could actually pass it, then those places where they were unable to complete would get an excuse. And then the last provision of it is that the person is entitled to a prorated refund for tuition or for the amount of room and board and fees that he was experienced while he was in the educational institution. So the gist of it is just to kind of put within our statutes the entitlement for those individuals, those veterans who have a disability-related issue from their military service, and give them the provision that we currently give our active duty folks. And I would stand for questions.
Anyone have a question? Supervisor Representative Mariano.
Sure, this might be actually more for Ms. Novak and I apologize for the silliness. I read the bill carefully through, but do the changes here do anything in terms of creating any uncertainty about eligible Minnesota students? And what I'm getting at is this is still tied to enrollment in our schools, students. Maybe it's not an issue. I'm thinking about the bill we had earlier with undocumented students, where we talked about the conditions for a student to be eligible for in-state tuition. So I guess that's my question. Is there anything here that challenges any of our in-state tuition definitions and students?
No way.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mariani, assistance for students under the military or the Minnesota National Guard provisions are handled differently than the state grant program, okay. So I don't believe it in any way challenges any of those in-state tuition, or has any of those in-state tuition issues we discussed with another bill.
Okay. Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question to the author, Representative Severson. On just as a case in point, on line, just a second. Shoot, where did I write it? On line 14, it says, institution who is ordered into active military. Now, I'm an RA-er. And I wouldn't qualify then under that. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dempsey, I think it says any student in a post-secondary educational institution who is ordered into active duty military service.
That's
as
correct.
Defined in section.
But, Mr. Chairman, what if, let's say, for example, I'm not ordered. I've joined. I haven't been ordered to go, but I'm an RA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I'm just wondering, I wasn't ordered in, I volunteered, okay, so I became an RA. No? And regular Army.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dempsey, can you tell me what an RA is?
Pardon?
Could you tell me what an RA is?
Take a guess, regular Army?
Regular Army, yeah. And the other one is U.S. is a draftee. Regular Army is enlisted. There's a difference between those two. There's different serial numbers. There are different obligations. There are different ways that you're handled when you come into after your basic training, and all the rest of that is different. So, I'm just wondering, are we excluding people that might have not been ordered, but have joined? And there's a difference between the two.
This is. Representative Severson, this is primarily dealing with students.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. And I think with the veterans who are coming back, they are enrolled in a higher education institution, and then for one reason or another, they have to go back and seek medical help for some of the conditions that are service related that would cut into their educational time. And so this precludes them from being penalized for having to go have a medical condition treated. As to the point that Representative Dempsey raises here, as I read this through, I think it probably opens it up a little more to any active duty service into active military rather than just the Minnesota National Guard. And I would say that probably expands the scope a little bit, although that is not particularly what this bill, the places where we're addressing in the bill are designed to go after.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
if you're comfortable with that language and it doesn't exclude regular Army people, that's okay with me. But
Mr. Chair and Representative Dempsey, I think it probably opens it up to include, is more inclusive for RA.
Okay.
That would be my read on it.
Any additional questions? If not, we will hold House File 2145, over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative Lanning. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm before you today on House File 1586. House File 1586 deals with some changes to the state grant program.
Representative Lanning, I'd like to move House File 1586 and for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What this bill all about is helping to maintain access to a college education on the part of our students who have need in the state of Minnesota. I'd like to point out at the beginning that I believe overall we need an increase in base funding for higher education in the state of Minnesota, but we also need to pay attention to our funding for the state grant program. Under current law, most students in Minnesota will end up getting less in state grant aid than they are currently. And this is due, of course, in part to the fact that the federal Pell eligibility standards have been changed, and that has also cut the state's share. HESOL estimates that we're going to have 50,000 students in Minnesota who are going to lose an average of $184 through the changes that have rippled the effect down to the state level. And while that amount doesn't seem like a huge sum, when you combine that with the tuition increases that students across the board are experiencing, I think it becomes a serious problem, a serious issue that we need to address. What House File 1586 does is calls for four basic provisions. The first is that the student's share would be reduced from 46% to 45%. It has been at that 46% level since 2001. And it would require the state share and the parent share to increase accordingly. Secondly, it increases the four-year tuition and fees cap by 5.5% increase in that cap over the period. And since 1997, we only have 202 students statewide, more students, that is, receiving a state grant than we had in 1997. And so eligibility has really not expanded. The third thing that this bill does is to put back in place the fifth year eligibility, fifth year of attendance. And we all know that for many students, finishing in 4 years has become more and more difficult. And so this would add back in the provision that fifth year of attendance also be covered. And finally, the fourth recommendation is that the miscellaneous expense allowance be brought back up to $5,405, the level that was at for 2001, 2, and 3, and then reduced in 04 to $5,205 and maintained at $5,205 in 2005. So this restores $200 that was previously cut. The governor has recommended a $75 restoration, and I don't believe that that is adequate, that we ought to restore it at the level it was previously, and obviously with inflation ever since, that number is still on the low side with that. With that, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mike Wilhelmy would like to also speak to this bill, and then we'll be happy to take any questions.
All right. Mr. Wilhelmy?
Montgomery, welcome again.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Wilhelmy, Minnesota Private College Council. First of all, I just wanted to thank Representative Lanny for bringing this bill forward. When Dr. Laird, the president of the Private College Council, and also Mr. David Etzweiler, who is the chairman of our Public Policy Committee of our board this year, Mr. Etzweiler is an executive at Medtronic, they described some concerns for the future of the state of Minnesota, some potential challenges to our ability to have a strong and vibrant economy in the future, mostly based upon demographics and also some economic realities that will be hitting the state in over the next decade or so. First, a reduction in the number of high school graduates who will be available to go on to post-secondary education. There are estimates that there will be 10% fewer high school graduates in 2013 than in 2003. Second, a demographic change in the graduating cohorts. There'll be substantially more high school graduates who we believe will be less academically and less financially capable and available to attend college than what we in all sectors of higher education in Minnesota are used to. Third, a strong potential growth for new jobs. DEED has revised economic forecasts, and they believe that the state of Minnesota will be growing jobs in the future at a good rate. And then finally, the retirement out of the workforce of a good number of educated people as the baby boomers age and prepare for retirement. And it's our belief that in higher education will be more important than ever to the state of Minnesota as we strive to have, a strong, vibrant economy in our state. To be competitive in a rapidly changing world economy, our people of the state, especially those who would, in their families, they would be the first generation to attend college, we must do a better job of making college available to them, making college affordable. And so we think that financial aid is not only something important that we do to help low and middle income people, but really it is a strategic state interest as our state strives to have a workforce that is available and ready to do work for the businesses of the state. I do have we have for you a couple of handouts. Representative Lanning referenced the program parameters over time of the state grant program. And we're also providing sort of a snapshot of federal and state financial aid for full-time dependent Minnesota students at all the state's institutions in a variety of income factors. And mostly with this, we wanted to show the impact of the Department of Education changes, changing eligibility for both Pell Grants and state grants. The Department of Ed is able to change our eligibility criteria because we use the same criteria as does the federal government in determining need for student aid. As you can see, the students that are hit hardest are those who are from middle-income families, mom and dad working full-time jobs, maybe making $14 an hour, $15 an hour, trying to send their child to college. Both their Pell and state grants will be cut this year for those who qualify for both, with the effects that you've seen here. And we're hopeful that that the combination of tuition increases and of reducing availability of financial aid, we hope that the legislature will react to that and fund the proposal that is contained in the bill.
Thank you. Any questions of Representative Lanning or
Mr. Chair? One question.
I think Representative Carlson raised his hand first.
Okay. Mine, I guess, would be of Representative Lanning, or maybe I could ask this question first. Is he still going to be testifying on the bill?
I'm not sure.
They might be the better ones. Otherwise, I would have to ask the author. No, they're not.
I don't believe so, no.
Representative Lanning, number of years ago, and you referenced it in your presentation, we changed the formula from 50% student share to 46. And the outcome of that was that it brought about quite a shift in the distribution of where those funds went. But one of the outcomes was, especially in the Minscu system, students attending two-year colleges. Technical colleges, community colleges were just dropped off the financial system altogether. And my recollection was it was like 10,000 students. Now that was a more dramatic drop going from 50 to 46 than 46 to 45. But my question is, what happens in terms of how that shift, one, between sectors when we go 46 to 45? And we've got four major sectors, the private proprietaries, the private colleges, which are now before us, and then the Minscu and University of Minnesota. what kind of shift it brings about between sectors, but in addition to that, and probably more importantly, how many students in our community and technical colleges may, if the same kind of thing happens, not receive any financial aid altogether? Because you stated your goal was to try to offset some of the Pell reductions. And Mr. Chairman, if HESO would be the better one to answer that question, they're in the audience. If they're not going to testify, I'd be happy to wait for them if Mr. Lanning doesn't have that available.
Mr. Wilhelmy might have a reaction.
Mr. Wilhelmy.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative, a student share reduction, I believe, would help all students in all sectors. I don't know how a student could lose their financial aid as a result of lowering the student share. Essentially, what the policy would be to essentially have the state have students pick up 1% less of their actual their tuition charge, and that the government and parents would pick up 1% more. So I believe that everyone would benefit from a student share reduction. I believe that was. I don't know how that would not be true.
Representative Carlson.
I recognize circumstances have changed a lot since you referenced, what was it, 98, when that change came about, but there were significant numbers of community colleges, technical college students, and state university students as a result of that shift to no longer receive financial aid. And with all the changes and higher tuition generally in the public sector, I quite frankly don't know what happens when we make this change, other than it's fair to say that we have to be careful. If we adopt this, I don't want to be receiving letters. I don't think anybody in the committee does from large numbers of students who no longer get any financial aid, if in fact that was the outcome. And I'm only basing that on the history of the change the last time we adjusted that part of it. And I think we need to have, if not at this meeting, Mr. Chairman, a clear answer to that question, so we know what these changes, who the winners and losers are.
I think, Representative Carlson, we're going to get an answer from HESO here in a second. A clarification.
Chairman, members, Mark Chance with HESO. To your question, Representative Carlson, Mr. Romney was right. The change in the percentages of the student responsibility would have no impact on a sector-by-sector basis, since all students would be affected as far as eligibility goes. Now, the fact that the costs are higher in the private sector than the public sector, there would be some distributional impacts that would be different for that reason, but not as far as eligibility for students. I think there's a number of other changes back in the period of time you talked about. The Pell Grant went up by about $230, and I think that may have had a larger impact as to the sectoral impacts that you were discussing as opposed to the change in the assigned student responsibility percentage.
Representative Pulaski,
Mr. Chair, this is for HESO also. Since the bill was not in the governor's recommendation, can you tell me, one, if the governor supports the bill, and then how would the governor adjust his budget recommendations to support the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pulaski, the cost of the bill is substantial, as you can see from the fiscal note. I assume you all have copies. So it's not clear to me what kind of other recommendations as far as moving money to the program would have occurred back in January and December.
Mr. Chair, that doesn't quite answer my question. I asked specifically if the governor supports the bill, and then if the governor supports the bill, how is the governor going to change his recommendations that you just went through with us last week?
Mr. Chair and Representative Plotsky, my name is Susan Hegar, Director of the Higher Education Services Office. As Mr. Mishkanis mentioned, that there's a substantial fiscal cost to this bill. The governor is a supporter of the state grant program. He has been for years as a legislator, and now as a governor, he's supportive of it. But I think, we're in a time of limited resources. So in terms of his budget recommendation, he was not able to fund the grant program. Hopefully in the future that will change. So if you're asking at this point in time, the money would have to come from somewhere else. I think in concept the governor supports additional resources for the grant program, but in terms of his budget right now, I don't know where we would find the additional revenue to pay for this.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Heger, thank you. That's the answer I was looking for, because given this division, the only way we would get to these numbers would be taking it from the accounts before us, which would be the university or the Minsky system or a couple of other accounts that are sitting before us. That's why I was curious as to the position of the governor specifically on the bill and then on where this money would come from, since there's no reference to it in his budget.
And again, Representative Pawlowski, if you, Mr. Chair, if you have a pot of gold, you know, hiding under one of these tables somewhere, you know, and some additional revenue, we'd love to know about it and spend some more money for the grant program. But right now, in terms of the governor's priorities and the way he set up his budget, I think he tried to maintain support for the grant program in terms of the status quo, but also provide some revenue for the systems.
So
I'm not speaking against the bill in concept, just in terms of the funding.
Representative Pawlowski.
The pot of gold is in back of you. It's called the Minsky system and the University of Minnesota system and everybody else, and they generate it by tuition and fees and a number of things. That's why I'm asking, because it does tend to fill up at times, but there's a cost to that filling up, and they bear the burden of it. So, okay, that's what I need to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Lanning, any final comments?
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I think we have an obligation to maintain access to higher education on the part of the students who have need, and I realize that we're going to have to find additional money somewhere, and we haven't yet set our targets, and as we look at setting targets, I believe that we need additional funding, both for base funding for higher education, public higher education, as well as funding for the state grant program, and we need to find a way to provide that additional revenue.
Thank you. House File 1586 then will be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Representative Carlson. Saved about 38 minutes for you.
Okay. Well, there is one other bill at the end.
That's
been pulled?
That's been pulled.
I appreciate that, because I do have a number of potential witnesses that I've contacted, and then I see on your agenda that there may be a couple more that do want to comment in. So I'm going to be relatively brief in my presentation so that you have a chance to hear from the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota system, and some of the
Carlson, students. Move your motion, move your bill.
Yeah, and I would move that House File 504 be recommended for possible inclusion in the higher ed finance bill. Mr. Chairman, this bill would do, it would allow each of the systems, and in this instance I'm referring to the private college council as one of the systems, but it would allow the University of Minnesota, the Minsky system, and the private colleges that are members of the private college council to administer their own financial aid program. The private proprietaries and some of the smaller private nonprofits, of which there are many in the state of Minnesota, would continue to have theirs managed by HESO. And the reason for that, there are a lot of them. A lot of them are relatively small operations, and they don't have anything that would be the equivalent of our two large public systems or the private college council to administer the financial aid. The reason for the bill, I was the chief author of the bill a number of years ago that went into conference committee when we were working on these issues along with another member at the time to set up the financial aid much of which is still in place today. There have been some fine tuning. We talked a little bit about student share and how that had been changed a few years ago, but basically the system is the same as it has been since the early 1980s. But the student profiles have changed immensely. And in my conversations with Minsky and the University of Minnesota because of those changes. And back in the early 80s, most of the students were probably 18 to 22, maybe 18 to 24. We have many more part-time, many more non-traditional students in our public systems. And both the university and MinSCU have, in my conversations with them and when we discussed a similar bill to this a couple of years ago, indicated that they would very much like to manage their own financial aid programs so that they could better meet the needs of their students. So what the bill would in essence do is take a picture of the current share that each of the sectors is receiving, and that would become their base funding as we would move forward into the next biennium. So everyone would get the same number of dollars available to their students as they would have now or as we enter the new biennium with whatever adjustments would be made in terms of the appropriation for financial aid. And they would then manage their own system, as I say, to meet the needs of their students. And so, Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do at this point, I think it's best that you hear from the two systems on the why. And I think if it would be all right if we could begin with the MinSCU system, because Peter Zetterberg, I think, just arrived and he probably wants to catch his breath. So unless you would prefer to go first or however you want to handle it, okay?
Good afternoon and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Peter Zetterberg. I work in the Office of Institutional Research and Reporting at the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota is very interested in this bill and supportive of it. We believe that a one-size-fits-all financial aid program no longer works as well as it should for all of Minnesota students in higher education in the various sectors. If you look at financial aid programs across the nation in the various states, 16 states really don't have strong financial aid programs at all. But of the 34 that do, 22 have more than one grant program for students. They have different grant programs for students in public institutions and private institutions. They have different grant programs for part-time students and full-time students. They recognize that it's very difficult to make just one program work well for very different kinds of students in very different kinds of higher education institutions. For an example of this, you need look no farther than our immediate neighbor to the east, Wisconsin, where the legislature makes different financial aid appropriations for the University of Wisconsin, for Wisconsin's private institutions, and for Wisconsin's technical colleges. Those are the three systems in that state. California does something very similar with its grant program. Ohio's another state that has multiple grant programs for different kinds of students and different kinds of institutions. The advantage of this from the university's point of view is really threefold. First of all, when the legislature was forced to make some very difficult decisions 2 years ago to reduce the size of the state grant program, it made a number of changes in the program. It eliminated the fifth year of eligibility, for example, and it eliminated summer grants. And HESO actually has done a study of the impact of these changes by sector. And what it shows is that these changes affected students in the different sectors in different ways. The private career schools, for example, were the most affected by the elimination of summer money, which is much more important to them than it is to the University of Minnesota. Four-year institutions obviously were much more affected by the elimination of a fifth year of eligibility, especially at the university where we have a large number of students in engineering. Doing away with the fifth year of eligibility hurt those students significantly. There's really no reason for that, and the only reason it happened, again, is because we're trying to make one state grant program work for very different kinds of students. If the state wants to provide a fifth year of eligibility, it doesn't need to do so for all students. It doesn't even need to do so for all students at the University of Minnesota. It only needs to do so for students who actually need 5 years in order to complete a degree like engineering. So the first
benefit is flexibility. The second benefit is efficiency. This is a very complicated looking bill, but the idea, the concept behind it is actually quite simple. It would be much more efficient for the university to manage multiple financial aid programs under the provisions of this bill. Right now we operate with one set of rules for the state grant program, and we operate with an entirely different set of rules for the Pell Grant program. Under the provisions of this bill, we could adopt the same set of rules, making it much more easy for students to understand how the system worked, making it much more efficient for us to manage the program. The third benefit, flexibility being number one, efficiency being number two, is that there would be a much better connection between tuition and financial aid, especially as Minsky and the university present their budget proposals to the legislature. I believe it would be much clearer just exactly how any proposed increase in financial aid was tied to proposed increases in tuition. Opponents of this bill, and I believe you will hear from some shortly, are going to make two points. First of all, they're going to suggest that the Minnesota State Grant Program is a model program for the nation. That's not actually true. If you look at other states, there aren't many who have exactly what Minnesota has. The reason the program is a model for the nation is because it's very well, strongly funded. And that's something that the University of Minnesota has always supported. The other thing they're going to say to you is that the advantage of having one state grant program is that it forces institutions to compete with one another. But the purpose of a financial aid program is not to force institutions to compete with one another. It's to provide financial aid to low-income students, period. And the question, the key question, is whether or not the current state program does that as effectively and as efficiently as possible. The University of Minnesota does not compete with private career schools for students. Private four-year colleges like St. Olaf do not compete with private career schools for students. The notion that we should have a financial aid program structured in a particular way just to force institutions to compete with one another, I think really makes no sense, especially when there are better alternatives that would result in a system that enables us to deliver aid to low-income students in a much more efficient and a much more effective way. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You want to identify yourself, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chris Halling, and I am Assistant Director for Student Financial Aid for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Peter has done a very good job of summarizing most of what I had to say, so I will be brief. But I would echo much of what he has said about what we perceive to be the advantages presented by this bill. Again, the flexibility is very important. To perhaps draw an illustration, changes that are made to the parameters of the existing state grant program often tend to have more of an effect upon one system than another. And we come before you then and sort of argue and feud about whether these changes are good from our perspective or bad from our perspective. Under this bill, we would have the opportunity to implement in our portion of the grant program those changes that are most beneficial for our students, as with the University of Minnesota, as with the private colleges. And we see that as a great advantage. We also think it retains or may even increase accountability back to the state, because there are requirements in here that we report back to HESO and back to you folks. We also see it as putting some of the onus on us to manage the funds if there is a possibility of a deficit, and we know there have been issues with trying to project the spending in this program in the past. We're very, very grateful for the state grant program that we've had. As Peter said, it is a very well-funded program. Our students appreciate that. We appreciate that. And we believe that the shared responsibility did very well in doing what it was designed to do at the time it was designed to do it. But as Representative Carlson mentioned, the program is, I think, 22 or 23 years old now under its current structure. And while it was changed a little bit over the years in terms of the parameters, it really hasn't been changed or examined closely during that time. I would just mention to you that we have students now whose parents received state grants under shared responsibility, who are preparing to graduate, having been in college themselves under shared responsibility. During that time, the institutions have changed, our missions have changed, certainly our student profiles have changed, the economy has changed, almost everything has changed, and we think that this bill is good in that it requires us all to take a look at trying to make some of those changes to reflect the changes in our students and in the state as a whole. So, thank you.
Mr. Holling, any questions? Representative Opatz.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Hollings, or perhaps for Dr. Zetterberg. One of the concerns that I've heard raised, and I'm not sure that I understand the concern, but let me just express it and see if you could respond to it, is that somehow this additional flexibility will lead perhaps to the University of Minnesota or the Minsky system to get away from, as you said, Dr. Zetterberg, its intent to provide resources to low-income students, that somehow that flexibility will become a ticket to use those the aid for other things, or perhaps what's a needy student for one system might be defined as a not needy student in a different system. So I'm not exactly sure I understood it, but is somehow that this the level of flexibility would raise some questions about whether some of the students who might be now defined as eligible really wouldn't, under the current system, be defined as eligible as needy. Can you respond to that?
Mr. Zetterberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Opatz. No, I mean, whatever funds were appropriated would be very strictly limited to providing aid simply to students who have demonstrated financial need. As a matter of fact, what I mentioned, improved efficiency and simplicity, we would probably award state grant funds as some percentage of the Pell Grant awards that students receive, so that only students who receive Pell Grants, the lowest income students, would actually receive any state grant funds. The money would absolutely not be used for any other purpose.
But, and again, just for purposes of argument, Mr. Chair, Dr. Zetterberg, is there anything in the bill that prevents you, though, from doing those things you're saying you wouldn't do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Opatz, I don't have the bill in front of me. I don't believe so. That was certainly never the intention.
Mr. Chair, Representative Opatz, I think there is a provision in the bill that requires, at least for Minsk, I'm not sure about the U of M, that the Board of Trustees must develop a plan for money appropriated for financial assistance must be used only for this purpose, and that our board will develop with the staff of the Office of the Chancellor a plan for the spending, and that will be known. So it seems to me that there is something in here that does address it. Page 6, Section 7, I think. Lines 24 and 25.
Mr. Chair, on that point.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, on that point, this is probably more a question for the University of Minnesota because of the uniqueness of its autonomous charter. Is there any conflict with state directive here and the charter of the University of Minnesota to set an alternative policy?
Dr. Zetterberg?
No. As a matter of fact, I think an appropriation like this would be exactly the same as what are called other state special appropriations the university receives. For example, the appropriations for the Agricultural Experiment Station and the Minnesota Extension Service are restricted to those purposes, and it would be the same with an appropriation for financial assistance or financial aid.
Mr. Chair, and there is, of course, one other piece of accountability here, which is that the systems would need to come back to this body for future funding.
Thank you very much. Susan Hegart.
Chairman, if I might, if the time still allows, I did have Judy Morgan who could comment briefly from Minsky, and then we also had student representatives from the Minsky system.
Okay, I intend to get to them as time permits. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I just thought maybe Susan Hegart had something relative to the discussion we just had. Would that be appropriate?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair and members, I'm Susan Hugard, I'm Director of the Higher Education Services Office, and I just wanted to offer some comments on this bill. The Governor and Higher Education Services Office support keeping the state grant program intact as a statewide program. The current state grant program in Minnesota is the envy of many states. Some states' financial aid programs only go to public institutions. Ours is institution neutral. It goes to privates and publics. It's based on student needs and their ability to pay. It's flexible, substantial, and integrates well with institutions and the Pell Grant program. And the current program sends dollars through students, whereby empowering them and recognizing enrollment changes. While many of us wish the grant program were larger or could do more for certain groups of students, this is not a solution. And one of the things I wanted to just mention before I proceed is that I heard some testimony that it's an old program, that it's an outdated program, and I guess I would just offer to you that just because the program's old doesn't mean that it's not good. And just in case there are those who think that because it's old it's not good, we are taking a look at the grant program this summer. We've been directed to do that. So if there are people that have concerns about it, have ideas about how to tailor it better for students, we're very open to that. But I think to argue that it's not flexible is inappropriate. The proposal being presented today to block grant financial aid to public and private organizations and systems is problematic for a number of reasons. It weakens the principle of student choice. I would argue that it poses an equity question. Students are treated differently by different institutions. Number two, I'd say that students are disempowered to vote with their feet. They may be targeted by one system and not by another. The proposal greatly diminishes the state and the legislature's role in how the state grant programs targeted to students. You lose power. No longer would you be involved in policy that would determine tuition maximums. I understand that they'd report back to you, but you're really losing your position in the driver's seat on this one. Institutional aid may be spent in ways that further the institution or the system's goals rather than the state's policy and strategic goals and the student's goals. Research on how institutions award their own institutional funds show that institutions try to influence the best prepared and highest achieving students, and we understand that. But they do that. They try to find the best students they can to attend their institution, so it might encourage cherry picking. It could pit systems against one another. Over time, this charges the legislature with objectively weighing and evaluating the changing needs of systems and their students to divide and appropriate the pie. How will you evaluate the need when each system is awarding funds differently? Block granting is one way to assure that financial aid is not likely to grow in the future. Look at what happens at the federal level, whether it's health care, welfare, other issue areas. Whenever you block grant, you're also talking about, in general, about streamlining the money as well. History shows generally that that money, as I said, which is block grant, it tends not to grow. It's easier to reduce funding for block grants than it is for direct student aid. Financial aid as a priority could change over time within the systems. Once student aid begins to compete with the needs of faculty and institutions inside the system, fuel costs, employee health, technologies, salaries, will it continue to be a priority? It also presents some communications challenges. It makes an already complex aid system more complex for students and their families. Students would have to consult each system to find out what their chances for aid are. Creates more need for infrastructure and not less. I would argue that it's not very efficient. There's a need for four different administrative systems. As students increasingly choose to take courses from more than one institution simultaneously, the financial aid construct becomes profoundly more complex under this proposed scenario. Communication with students and parents would be more complex as well. The lack of clarity would be particularly difficult for first-generation students, and I hear a number of you talk about how important you think it is that we focus on first-generation students and their needs. There would be inconsistency and no centralized source for information. And finally, I thought I would just note that the Private College Council is not a state-regulated entity. They're registered lobbyists, and the analogy we were thinking of is would the legislature block grant Minnesota Care payments to HMOs? I don't think you would. I don't want to predict behavior, but I guess we sort of see a similar analogy there. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll sit for questions, and I know there are a number of other witnesses who would like to testify.
Representative Marion.
Just one quick question, because I know we don't have a whole lot of time, but Ms. Seagard, Mr. Soderbergh mentioned Wisconsin, California, Ohio as some states where there's a multiple system in place for administering the grant programs. Has HESOL been able to take a look at how those are working, any of those states, and been able to do any kind of assessments?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, I have Cheryl Mapplethorpe here from our agency who could, I think, respond better than I to that question.
Cheryl Mapplethorpe from the Higher Education Services Office. I belong to an organization called NASGAP, National Association of State Student Grant and Aid Programs, and so I am familiar with the way other states handle their financial aid programs. In some other states, they do split the state grant programs so that there might be one program just for private colleges, one program for public colleges, or they might split it full-time, part-time, just as previous testimony. One of the problems with that is that the legislature has to constantly try to figure out how many part-time students are you going to have, how many full-time students are you going to have, and inevitably you guess wrong. It's better to have it in one pot of money so that it's as students change what they're doing or where they enroll, the money follows the student, instead of creating a structure that hogties where the money is. I guess that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much. You need this phone number, right? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson,
Mr. Chairman, I have the additional components that I need to complete their testimony first.
Sure.
Thank you.
Judy Borkin, is that the next?
Yeah, and then student representatives, at least one. I'm not.
Okay.
One. Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Judy Borkin, with the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I just am here to say that from the administrative side of the operation, I think you've heard from Chris Hollings that Minsky would be in support of this bill if this were to be passed, and that we would be ready to take on the administrative burden of that if the bill were to be passed for our students.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Yes, thank you very much. Justin? Okay, it's Brad. What's the last name?
Krasselink.
Okay. And Justin Paul, is it?
That's right.
Okay. And Justin, you're going to go first.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Paul, committee members. I am the president of the Minnesota State College Student Association. This bill offers, instead of a one-size-fits-all, giving out grants, this offers a potential for Minsky, U of M, and the Private College Council to tailor a formula that would be best served to all the students' needs. The state grant program is currently kind of unfriendly to the part-time students of the state of Minnesota. And as a representative of the two-year community colleges and tech colleges, that's 51% of our population. Many of these people go to school part-time because their life circumstances dictate that they have to do it that way. They can't take a full load because they have to take care of family, or they have they have jobs that they have to take on in order to pay for their tuition. I think it is true that while some students do receive financial aid, that a new formula would be better served to reach out to the part-time students of the state of Minnesota as well. I feel that a new calculation would be more fair and the part-time state grant recipients, because students take fewer hours, and the only real cost is lower tuition. For example, while attending a college on a part-time basis, students' rent payment is not prorated, and he or she still eats just as much as if he or she were still a part-time or a full-time student. On a final note for myself, I note that the state grant program is about as old as I am. I'm 21 years of age. It's 22. And I really think that I've gone through a lot of changes in those 21 years. I don't know about anybody else, but I think I've grown a little bit. And I urge the committee to take this opportunity to open up a discussion about financial aid and welcome new approaches to administrating the state grant so it best meets the needs of all the students across the state of Minnesota. Thanks for your time.
Brad Krasselway, welcome.
Thank you for allowing me to speak today. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Brad Krasselway. I'm the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association. Representative Carlson's bill is attempting to fix a problem that we have had for years. Whether it's talking about a surplus, a deficit, or students being dropped off the programs in general, I think most of us can agree that the state grant program is broken and we need to fix it. Giving Minsky and the U the opportunity to administer the financial aid programs gives them the autonomy to adhere them to best fit the students that go to the Minsky campuses. I personally strongly believe that low tuition is the best form of financial aid because it gives each individual student the opportunity to weigh the cost of the institution versus the size of their pocketbooks, rather than the state trying to decide what is best for them through a one-size-fits-all program. But if Minsky was administering it, then financial aid could be better utilized within the student's calculation. Minsky could sell the programs during the recruitment visits, their counseling sessions, and financial aid counseling sessions more effectively. Minsky also has a consultation process that is superb, and letting the system office, along with the students, really shape the financial aid programs to best fit the students' need would be an excellent opportunity that should not be missed. Please support this bill, and I will stand for any questions.
Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And,
Mr. Chairman, that would conclude all of the testimony that I had. I'm not sure if there are others.
I think there may be at least one more.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Clubber with the Minnesota Private College Council. After Mr. Zetterberg said that he'd make the arguments for the others, I wasn't sure I would have to come up here. But neither of the points he made will I bring up again, nor did I in this sentence. And I will be brief. I have my notes marked down, so that keeps me brief. This bill, in the name of efficiency, sets four sets of rules and standards instead of one. One argument used for separate programs is that each system is unique and should be able to tailor their own programs to their own needs. What happens if one program is more generous to part-time students? Another chooses to treat independent students more generously or to grant independent status more often. A third chooses to recognize a higher tuition cap. Each budget year, and possibly annually, your committee would need to judge the relative merits of the decisions made by the four separate financial aid systems. System 1 is out of funds because they made what some legislators might feel was an unwise standard change, one that the other three did not. Wouldn't it be incumbent on the legislature to say, we'll fund your next request, but you must change that standard? What about the question of compliance? If the financial aid super director of one of the four programs discovers an abuse or misapplication of the standards by a member school, are they likely to report that finding, and to whom do they report it? How do you, as legislators, apportion the funds available for financial aid to each of the four new programs? The author suggests that the first year you'll do it based on the previous biennium's experience. What is to say that those percentages of needy students will remain constant, especially if the definition of need varies? I believe the legislature would soon realize they need some agency to sort out the relative merits of the standards changes and how well each program is doing in meeting the needs of low and moderate income students. That would return you to where you are right now, a stronger HESO or a cloned agency with the same responsibilities. There is an inherent conflict built into this bill for the two public systems. Their request for direct appropriation brings in relatively unrestricted funds. Their request for financial aid is very restricted in its use. The request for a large financial aid appropriation could affect the success or the amount of their direct appropriation request. We've heard it here for years, and we've heard it here again today. Low tuition is the best form of financial aid. I think most public institutions would be inclined to ask, give us as much as you can in the direct appropriation, because they see that as a form of financial aid. Governor Lopez, you and I didn't have this conversation, but I'd like to comment on your last comments about flexibility, whatever. All systems, including privates, face a possible conflict in being tempted to minimize the number of the most needy students you accept into your schools. One student with a need for a $4,500 grant could prevent the system from accepting three students that need $1,500 to complete their enrollment. The temptation would be let one of the other systems, let one of the other programs help that student. And one last comment from being last and able to hear the others. There was a comment made that we would keep it simple. We might even do something like take a percentage of your Pell Grant and add that on as your state grant. One of the glaring problems of Pell Grants is that independent workers, students who work, can work themselves out of a Pell Grant. Congressman Sable has worked unsuccessfully. He's a relatively successful congressman. But he's worked unsuccessfully for years to try and change that part of the Pell Grant, where students who work themselves out of eligibility for a Pell Grant. They can earn enough money, they earn it themselves out of eligibility. Their parents, if they had earned the same amount of money, they would still be eligible. So, Mr. Chairman, I would hope that you would consider keeping the program the way it is, as one program, one uniform program. I know it's going to undergo some scrutiny this year. It underwent scrutiny with the Humphrey Dorman Commission years ago, and I hope you'll wait until that report comes in. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Carlson, we have a little time left.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just have a few brief comments that I might make and then take any questions that members might have if they do. First of all, I'd like to point out something that's very hard for a state agency to change, and that's what we're talking about here is change. When we first went with the shared responsibility 20-some years ago, the debate was hot and heavy then, you know, when we brought about those changes. So sometimes it is difficult to address change. I would point out that the different sectors compete now, and I didn't mention that as one of my goals, but it was to eliminate or reduce that competition. If anyone, and there are a lot of new members of the committee, but anyone that's been here for past bienniums, especially when we debated change in the financial aid system, knows that some of our hottest and most difficult debates have centered on changes within that formula and who the winners and losers may be. And I think if each system comes in and advocates for their need, that would greatly reduce that competition between the different sectors. The concern that was expressed, what if they didn't use the money as intended? We could very easily put in a line item appropriation for each of the systems, and the bill also addresses that it has to be used for needy students, so you could make sure that the dollars are only used for financial aid purposes. The point that was made about the private colleges not being able to administer the program because they're a private entity, you do have to have a fiscal agent, and that would be ESO. There are any number of examples in state government where state agencies do in fact contract with private entities to carry out a program. If that were a difficulty in the eyes of the committee, you could very easily amend the bill that the private colleges, along with the private proprietaries and the smaller private nonprofits, continue to utilize HESL. You wouldn't have to force that upon them if they didn't want it. Other point that I would make is that the last testifier pointed out that we now have one standard, and the whole thing issue that's now before us, or the reason it's before us, is that one standard isn't working for all of the different sectors, and that's what we're trying to do is bring about the flexibility so that we do have a financial aid program that is tailored by each of the sectors to meet the needs of their students. And I would only remind the committee that each biennium they would have to report back on how they're utilizing those resources. We would ask the appropriate questions, and I know the history of this committee, and we would want to make sure that that aid was being targeted to the most needy students and that we were improving access. So I have a lot of trust in both MNSCU and the University of Minnesota on that question, and I would hope that the committee would as well. But I'll stop with my comments, but I did want to respond to some of the points that were made, and we all know that sometimes change is difficult.
Thank you, and we're right on time. There are no other questions. So, Representative Carlson renews his motion that House File 504, is it?
That's right.
Be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus finance bill. Thank you, and with that, our meeting is adjourned.